Okay, so we're talking about lab four and room clear today, and hopefully, have you guys all started looking at lab four at least? Apparently some change I made yesterday makes some sort of deal. So I'll take a look at that in an hour or so. But other than that, most things should be working. All right, so like I said, it takes a little while to start now. Watch the first couple screencasts to get started. There's a couple errors in the screencast. Sorry about that. But they're on the webpage, so just read the little footer on the webpage up there, the error I made on that around the file. And we'll talk about ICMP and R for the lab, and we'll also talk about the webpage that we talked about Thursday. So let's go on. So first, I just want to make the point that each router interface has its own MAC address and its own IP address. So an IP address doesn't uniquely name a host. It uniquely names an interface on a host. So this is something that a lot of people get wrong. They think that your machine has one IP address. It actually has one IP address for each network interface in your machine. So since your router is connected to four things, it has to have four network parts. That means it has four MAC addresses, one for each network part, and four IP addresses, one for each of those MAC addresses. Does everyone understand that? Hopefully. So let's just go move on to how IP datagram is encapsulated into the Ethernet frames. Here's the Ethernet frame format. You have your destination MAC address, you have your source MAC address. Those are 6 bytes long, so 48 bits each. Then this ether type, which tells you what type of, what's the type of the payload. Be in our lab, either IP or ARC. And so we forward this packet one hop. So we're an IP router, so we're going to inspect the IP datagram inside this Ethernet frame. So to forward it one hop, we actually have to change the destination MAC address to the MAC address of the next hop. Because remember, our router is just taking the packet, moving it one hop until so the next router can move it another hop.
Yeah. So we don't need to change the source.
No. Oh, yeah. You have to set your source MAC address should be the source MAC address of the outgoing interface. So yeah, you have to change the source MAC address too. But that's not as hard because it's hard coded into your network part, right? The question is how do you get the destination MAC address? Because your routing table only has the next hop IP addresses. So you need some protocol that maps IP addresses, next hop IP addresses, to the next hop MAC address. Does everyone see that? You have to rewrite this first 6 bytes in the frame of the destination MAC address of the next hop. The destination IP address, we need to keep the same. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so that's why we need ARC. That ARC is just a protocol that you can ask questions like who has the IP, 192.168.3.5, and the reply will come back 192.168.3.5's MAC address is whatever it is. And so that's how you can actually figure out what the next hop MAC address is. So for example, suppose you get a packet destined for this 128.12.94.3, and if you look at this routing table, that only matches the first entry, which is the default route. So that means I have to send my packet to the next hop, which is 5.10.1.1, that first entry there. So how do I get my Ethernet frame 5.10.1.1? I have to figure out the MAC address of 5.10.1.1. So to do that, we have to send off an ARP request. And the format for ARP request is here. And there's a struct SR ARP header and SR protocol.h that will make it easier to set these fields. So we have this hardware type, which is just going to be Ethernet. ARP header ether, this protocol type, which is the IP. So you can use ARP to resolve different types of protocols together. We're just going to use it to resolve IP addresses to MAC to Ethernet MAC addresses. But you could theoretically use it for other protocols as well. So that's why these H type and P type fields are four. Then you have the length of these fields, which for H1 should be 6, B1 should be 4, because there's 6 bytes in a MAC address, 4 bytes in an IP address. Sorry. And then you have the operation, which can be a request or a reply. And then here's the source to target back to IP packets. Any questions?
If we just copy those directly from, like, if we're sending a reply, if we copy those first four fields directly from an incoming request,
yeah,
would they hold?
They should be correct.
Okay.
Yeah. But you should check them, right? You should sanity check the ARP request before you, like,
why do it?
You have to sanity check the ARP request to make sure. So by the time you get the code that's sending the reply or sending the request, you should, or by the time you get the code that's sending the ARP reply, then they should be correct already. Like, before you operate on the ARP request, it should be ARP pattern ether type IP, H1M6, P1M4, and it's an ARP request. So you can find these packet formats
to link to on the assignment web page.
Here's like generating an ARP request. So for example, let's say I want to find out the next hop MAC address for the IP 192.168.1.3. So I'm going to create an ARP request with these fields. The source hardware address, the source protocol address, that's just my MAC address and my IP address. And I'm going to ask for the hardware address, the MAC address of this 192.168.1.3. And I'm going to send this ARP request because I don't know where to send it, right? I'm trying to figure out what the MAC address is. So I don't know what the MAC address is. So I just put on the destination MAC address of the broadcast address, which is all Fs, all ones. So I'm going to send this ARP request out of my outgoing interface to everybody that I'm connected to. Any questions? All right, then suppose the other side is handling the ARP reply, ARP request, or I'm handling the ARP request, someone sent me an ARP request. So I get the request, it looks like a question, who has 192.168.1.3? And you reply with your MAC address, or the receiver replies with their MAC address. So the receiver sets its source protocol address to 192.168.1.3 and then it fills in their hardware MAC address. And it sends the ARP reply directly to the requester. So remember the request is a broadcast to everybody through the MAC broadcast address. But the reply is sent just to the sender. Yeah.
So if requests are broadcast, do routers forward requests?
No, so this is link layer, right? So routers are operating at layer 2. They're operating at the network layer. So there's an IP broadcast address too, but this is an Ethernet broadcast address. So things that are operating at the Ethernet level, like switches or hubs, we talked about briefly before, maybe we can get to it later today, but those would have to forward the broadcast. But
so for a router, if you get a request and it's not for you,
yeah, so if you think about it, so these broadcasts only to everybody connected on the same Ethernet wire. So you can share an Ethernet wire across multiple nodes. Either like physically, like you have just one wire and you have multiple taps onto the wire, or logically, like through a hub. So a hub is just like a repeater, so it looks like one big wire, even though it's actually many wires connected to a hub. So here's like, say there's MIF 1, MIF 2, MIF 3. If you actually look at these all have the same subnet mask, and they're all living on the same subnet. So you actually can just send. There actually no next hop IP cable or routing cable. They can just send. There's just like a star if you run the ARP cable, so they can just send a frame out to the network on the link layer, and the link layer will figure out how to get it to that other address because they're all. It's like as if they're all on one big Ethernet wire. So when you send in the broadcast MAC address, it's just sending to everyone connected here. So if there's a router here, and then another LAN on this side, the broadcast only goes to one side. The broadcast is only to this LAN that's connected to this single Ethernet wire. It doesn't go through the router, which is a layer 3 device, and to the other. So it does not global broadcast.
Make sense.
Any other questions on this? Okay, so now we've gotten the ARP reply. Either the other guy has gotten my ARP reply or I've gotten the ARP reply from someone else. So the reply is I have an IP of 192.168.1.3. My MAC address is 0011223445566. That would be the difference in text. So I just do some filtering, just make sure that the target IP of the ARP reply is the IP of the interface that's came in. In other words, make sure that this ARP reply was actually directed to me. Because if you look back here, or there's a target IP address and a target MAC address. So just make sure that you are actually the target of this ARP reply before you process it. So here's your ARP reply. So now I'm going to add the IP and MAC mapping to the ARP cache, which is just going to cache away all these MAC address and IP mappings. And there might be packets that were waiting on this ARP reply, right? Because there are certain packets that are waiting to figure out what the next hot MAC address is. So here's where you actually send off the packets that were waiting on the ARP reply once you get the reply. So you're going to have to do this in your code, yeah?
Are they cumulative? Five packets are waiting for my the same packet.
Yeah.
When I come back, you know, they don't send it.
Yeah, it should be cumulative. So the thing, the data structure I gave you, the ARP request queue thing, it should be cumulative. So you can insert a request in the request queue, and if it's already there, then it just adds the packet to a linked list of packets that's waiting for that ARP request. So what happens is when you get the ARP reply, you basically, there's a function that moves things from the request queue to the mapping, to the ARP cache. So there's a ARP request queue and this ARP cache, you move one thing to the other, and it gives you back that entry, which has a linked list of packets that were waiting for the reply. So then you would go through each packet, fill in the next hot MAC address, and then send off the MAC, send off the packet. So you'll have to do that. I mean, I gave you sample code on how to use the ARP request queue and ARP cache in the header file, so hopefully you should do that. Yeah. All right, so given all that, you're going to have to generate the ARP requests, you're going to have to process the ARP replies, and you also have to process ARP requests. So basically you have to generate and process ARP requests and ARP replies to make your lab tool work. And there's one more thing, because there's this ARP request queue that I was talking about. So these are all the ARP requests that have been sent out so far. And you're going to have to go through the queue every second and send off or resend the ARP request, basically. There's a function that already gets called every second, and it should be pretty trivial to write this function. But this is so that ARP request gets reset if the reply doesn't come back within a second. The new assignment web page should have a note about this somewhere, and also the code should have a comment giving an idea of what to write in this function. But this is so that basically ARP requests are resent in case it was lost. And if we don't get a reply within after five ARP requests, you have to send an ICMP destination host unreachable back to the center. But otherwise you would be able to figure out the what was down to the sender. So you're gonna have to manually write this. The ARP cache is given to you, and like, the headers on like the ARP header, protocol header is given to you. I mean, a lot of stuff is given to you. You just have to glue it all together, write the logic to generate and process these requests. Any questions?
Just checking here, you were saying earlier that you don't actually, for every second, it's just the next time another request comes in, and it's been at least a second since.
Yeah, so it could be, because this thing gets called about every second. It's like an extra thread that gets kicked off. But it was kicked off for you. So I changed the code a bit to make it not purely measured, and I added a thread that gets called every second. So it's there's more timeout guarantees now. So obviously when you say sleep one, it doesn't actually literally sleep 1 second. You don't have real timeout. Could be a little off, but it'll get sent about every second. But basically, you'll have this linked list of requests. So you have a linked list of requests, and they're going to some IP address, right? And they have some packet, some list of packets waiting on this IP to MAC address mapping. So simple, singly linked list, and then the idea is if it's on the request queue, you should have already sent out the ARP request once. And then there's some field in it that says how many, when was the last time it was sent, which you have to update. And there's another field that says how many times has it been sent, which you also have to update. And so every second, iterate through this list and clean up the list of any entries that have been sent at least 5 times, and resend any entries that haven't been sent within a second.
Another packet for the same IP that we don't have, should we reset the counter of how many times we can send the ARP request?
Yeah, don't do that, right? So it's easier to do it that way too, because the way the ARP cache works, you just literally just pass an insert packet and it'll just add the packet to the, you'll add a packet to this link list.
Okay.
And won't touch the field, other field. Okay. So the idea is, like, if you have 100 packets the same IP address, you shouldn't send out 100 ARP requests.
Right.
So we have this ARP cache because we don't want it, you know, for the same reason. We want to make sure that we don't keep sending ARP requests to the same place. Because if you had no ARP cache, you would have to send ARP requests for every single packet you're sending out. So that would be really bad, right? So we have this ARP cache that gets timed out every 15 seconds, which is where the entries are timed out every 15 seconds. And that's done for you already as well. So that will hopefully cut down the number of ARP requests we need to make. Any questions? All right, so there's another port quality to understand, which is ICMP, which is the Internet Control Message Protocol. And this is what's used to send messages back to the sender host in the case of some circumstance that's unusual. It's also used for some of these control messages, like ICMP echo request, which is a ping. So when you run ping IP address, so ping 192.168.1.3, then you, if you're that IP address, you'll get an ICMP echo request packet, and you have to generate an ICMP echo reply packet. It's nothing too complex, but just follow the spec on how to generate the packet. And the destination host unreachable is, like what I said before, it's either when you can't find a route in the routing table. So if you didn't have a default route in your routing table and you're asked to send a packet to some place where you don't know how to get it, so there's no match in the routing table, you could send a destination host unreachable. And also, if you send 5 ARP requests and you don't get an ARP reply back, you should also send a destination host unreachable. And you should think about some way to test this mechanism to make sure it actually works. But obviously, testing out the functions of all these quality work, right? You'll never get a destination host unreachable. So think of some way to actually test destination host unreachable with your router. And manually or R table in some way to get the destination host unreachable. And then you also have to send a destination port unreachable. That's if a packet comes to your router, to one of the interfaces on your router, and it's TCP or UDP, then you should send a destination port unreachable back. And you need to do this to make trace route work. So if you can get, you can trace route or trace path to your router, then you'll be able to test whether the destination port unreachable is working. And these are all kind of straightforward, just fill in the packet format with the right code and type of code for each of these messages, and then each of these messages has its own has its own payload format. So you'll have to click on the details for ICMP destination unreachable, and then you'll have to figure out what payload has to go into it, like the first, the IP header plus the first 8 bytes of the IP payload or something like that. But it's all pretty straightforward. It's just filling out packets essentially. which is all the ports, right? Because you're an IP router, so you should generate that for any TCP or UDP. Any TCP or UDP segment. So you get an IP packet that's addressed to you, so you're supposed to open it up, right? But it's containing a TCP or UDP payload, but you don't know what to do with it, so you send this destination port unreachable. There's also the destination protocol unreachable for this. Use the port unreachable, otherwise it trades around the port. Any questions? And of course, the other protocol you have to understand is IP. Obviously you have to understand that. Any other questions on the lab?
Type 5 is involved also.
Still working on it. Hopefully a little less involved, maybe. There probably will be less low-level things to do. Probably. We'll see. I'm working on it still. But this lab has been given to a lot of people. This is not the first time the lab's been given. It's been given to a lot of universities before. It's one of the VNS labs. Yeah, it's been given to 44 as well, except minus microcoders we added on the assignment. All right, so just quickly going over the basic flow diagram again. So you receive a raw Ethernet frame, you see whether it's an ARP or an IP payload inside the Ethernet frame. So if it's ARP payload, then you just do the stuff that I just talked about. If it's an IP packet, if it's sent to yourself, you see if it's an ICMP echo request. If it is, send an ICMP echo reply. If it's an IP packet and it has TCP or UDP inside, then send the ICMP port unreachable, like I just said on the previous slide. And now if it's not sent to yourself, so the destination address is not one of your router's IP addresses, and you're being asked to forward the packet, so then you have to go through this longest prefix match on the routing table. If you don't find a match, you have to send that post unreachable like I said before. If you see a match in the routing table, now you can figure out what the next hop MAC address is by checking the ARP cache. So if you find a hit in the ARP cache, you just send it off right away. No hit, then you have to add the request to the ARP queue and send off the ARP request if necessary. And then basically in the ARP reply code, that's when you're actually going to send off the packet that's waiting on this ARP request. So, there's a lot of blocks here, but if you think about each of these blocks isn't that much code. Like LPM, it's more than 10 lines, you've done it wrong. So, and these things are building on that. So, it seems like a lot of complexity, a lot of things to keep your wrap your mind around, but it's mostly just to make you understand all the mechanics of routing. But the general idea of how to forward a packet is relatively straightforward. More lab for thoughts, you might want to organize your code a bit more. So you could put all your code in srouter.c. You might not want to do that because it'll be really long. If it works for you, it's fine. I'm just saying, you might not want to do that. So you can split it up into multiple files. So here's an example organization here. And you can try to do one thing at a time. I just realized this example map here is not totally right because ICMP is inside an IP packet. So for example, if you do just ARP and IP, then you should go forward the packets, just the ARP and IP paths. You just do this forward packet and ARP path, and you should build at least forward packets to the application service. And then ICMP is something you'll have to tack on after that, because you have to put the ICMP packet into an IP packet, because you have to send out sending it out just like any other IP packet. And when you send out these ICMP messages, they're just like any other IP packet. So you should do the same mechanics, do the longest prefix match, send out the ARP request if necessary, and so forth. So when you send out the ICMP message, it should just go through the same path as the forwarding an IP packet to the next hop. Any other questions? So, yeah, I guess still have like a week, I guess, or 5 days or something. That's a little bit wider than like a week and 2 days or something, maybe a day, right? It's a little part of that. So, just want to, someone asked about the, it was you, right? Asked about the MAC address uniqueness, or was it someone else that wrote a comment about whether MAC address has to be, MAC address has to be unique. So, MAC addresses, I just want to answer this question quickly, because if it doesn't come up on this, at some point, you're probably going to ask this question. We keep going in networking, so people know whether you actually know how networks are composed. So you suppose you have some routers, and they're each connecting some LANs. So here's an Ethernet wire, and it's shared by a bunch of nodes. Could be anything, right? So, each of these nodes, each of these interfaces, like I said before, has its own IP address and MAC address, right? But the IP addresses, as long as they're global IP addresses, like not an added private IP address, they should be globally unique. You know, in other words, every interface in the entire world should have its own unique 32-bit IP address. But these MAC addresses, as we've talked about in the past like 20 or 30 minutes, they only have to be unique across the when we're sending across to the next hop. So every MAC address on this LAN here, so every MAC address, this MAC address, this MAC address, all these MAC addresses have to be unique because that's how we're figuring out how to send the frame to the next hop, like we were talking about in the ARP section. So suppose we're this router, we want to send a packet to the next hop. Well, the only way to send a frame to the next hop is by putting a different destination MAC address on the frame. So clearly all the MAC addresses here have to be unique, because otherwise this router couldn't figure out how to send a frame to just one of these nodes. Right? So if these two nodes have the same MAC address, then if I sent a frame to the next hop to this node, it would also go to this node. That would cause a lot of havoc in your network, because you wouldn't be able to uniquely name a node. But it only has to be unique locally. So if I have another node here, this guy's MAC address could be the same as this guy's MAC address, and no one would know the difference, because they're not directly connected to each other through another node. So that's the meaning of the MAC address having to be locally unique. So this guy's MAC address is X, and this guy's MAC address is X. We have a problem, because this router here can't send a frame to just one of these nodes. But if this guy's MAC address is X, and this guy's MAC address is X, it doesn't matter. Yep.
I'm
going to
put that
back
machine.
Yeah, so you can't really guarantee with like DHCP and like mobile IP addresses that they'll move onto the same network. So they should still be like unique, but they don't have to be, is what I'm saying. Because it's all configurable in software. You can give yourself any MAC address you want. Right? This is how the MAC address spoofing stuff works on your router. So I'm just saying it doesn't have to be unique. You could have the same MAC address on the same topology, as long as they're not connected to the same node somewhere. But yeah, from the manufacturer, they should come with a different MAC address for each network part.
From security, you want organizations do to prevent people from like spoofing their MAC address.
Yeah, like Stanford has this thing where you have to enter your MAC address in the database. You can't do anything, right? If you just get somebody else's MAC address, then you can become them for Stanford. So say you're on the Stanford network, you just listen to network that's coming past with the network snipper, and you see somebody's MAC address. Presumably they have a real IP address. So you just set your MAC address to their MAC address, and boom, you're on the Stanford network, you have an IP. So it's not really security mechanism. It's just annoying for you to like get onto our network.
What are they doing to prevent this? That's what I was asking.
Yeah, there's no way to prevent it because it's just a clear text. So if you use MAC address for your security, don't rely on it for like foolproof security. It's just more or less there for like, to make it a pain for other people to get onto your network. So like your router could have MAC address like filtering, So that makes it more annoying to get on your network, but that doesn't stop anyone from just opening a, putting their network card in promiscuous mode, sniffing all the traffic that comes by, and then picking one of the MAC addresses and popping onto your network with that MAC address.
Just on that topic, I guess last week, Professor Charity in distributed systems was telling us about how the military is having trouble just with that problem.
Yeah.
People putting like bogus MAC addresses out there, you know, messing up routers.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, right, what happens when two nodes have the same MAC address? It's actually kind of bring out your network kind of thing. So it's kind of not so good to have good MAC address on the same subnet. Okay, so I just want to go over that quickly. So another thing we went over on Thursday is just this general idea of we have one Ethernet wire and we want to share it amongst multiple clients. And this is just a general principle in all systems. I just want to point it out. So a lot of times in these classes, you just think to yourself, oh, more details about something I'll never think about again. Or more low-level details about some low-level concept I'll never use in real life. But it actually, it's just a general concept. You have shared resource, and you want to figure out how to arbitrate access to that shared resource. There's only one guy who can use it at a time, coherently. So, for example, you have a shared CPU and multiple processes needed, so you arbitrate access to one CPU through the OS scheduler. And you have shared radio spectrum, and multiple radio stations want to broadcast onto the radio spectrum, so you lose frequency, you need multiplexing. So everyone broadcasts on different frequency. Now everyone can share this shared radio spectrum, use the shared radio spectrum. And then in our case, everyone, there's one Ethernet cable and multiple clients connected to that one Ethernet cable. How do we arbitrate access to that one Ethernet cable? We use this thing called CSMACD. It's point and sense, multiple access, collision attack. So it's just an algorithm for figuring out how we can share this one shared resource. And it's not the only algorithm you can use. There's other things like tokenized, Aloha, et cetera, in the book. But it's one thing you can use to arbitrate access to this shared wire. And it becomes probably, right? Maria's doing the research in wireless, right? So probably this stuff is probably more interesting for the wireless space. So I'll just propose to you that CSMACD, you can use it inside the classroom, right? So we could say that I'll make this protocol, and it's a protocol that a lot of people use, like maybe my home section or something. Anyone can talk at any time. If I hear anyone else talking, I won't talk because someone else is talking. If I start talking and then someone starts flying with my talking, then I stop talking and I back off for some random time until that someone stops, until the line is not busy again, and I start talking and I repeat this process. Right?
I mean, this is essentially the same thing as happening in wireless. Because
yeah.
You're using the air. Right?
So here's your collision sense multiple access collision attack that you're using in the ion section. But you can also use it in Ethernet. Right, so before I send, I'll sense the wire to see if anyone else is sending. If anyone else is sending, I won't send anything. If someone else is sending, or no one is sending, I'll start sending. But even just because the line was not busy when I started sending doesn't mean that it won't become busy. So if I start sending and sense that someone else has started sending, then I'll stop, back off for some exponentially increasing time, and then hope that no one else is sending them when I try to retransmit. And that's why CSMACD in Ethernet is known as an exponential backoff algorithm. Because when you detect a collision, you back off for a random amount of time, but that random amount of time is increasing exponentially with the number of times you've backed off. So the idea is that you just keep randomly waiting. You keep waiting a random amount of time, and that time keeps increasing. Then eventually someone's going to have an open slot to broadcast their frame or to broadcast their frame over this shared wire.
Yeah. So in lecture, it was mentioned that this isn't really used anymore because collisions don't happen anymore.
Right.
I wasn't really clear on why that is. Like, this makes sense. But
the reason why is because I'll get to it later. The reason why is everyone's moved from this shared network to like, because you don't actually see one Ethernet wire with multiple taps in it anymore, right? With multiple hosts connected
to it. everyone.
And you could, I mean, you could logically still have that if you have a hub and multiple nodes connected to the hub. That's the exact same thing as this, actually. So you can still get this if you have a network that's connected by a hub. But most networks are now connected by switches. And switches basically terminate the wire at both ends so that there's only two hosts on either side of the Ethernet wire. So then you'll never get a collision because there's only two guys on it. Like just one guy couldn't talk to the other guy and the other guy talking to the first guy. So you don't have two nodes, you don't ever get a collision, so you never get this run this out.
Do you get a collision if they both start sending at the same time if there's only two?
I don't think so. There's four wires there, right? So there's it's full duplex. So it's not just like one guy sent the other guy. Yeah, I think the Ethernet wire can carry two signals. I'm not sure. You know that?
Ethernet wire carries
multiple
nodes going from that like direction.
Yeah, it's four wires, right? So you build all two signals. Two voltages. Okay, so there's a limitation as we talked about in the lecture. I don't know if this is totally clear to everyone. So there's a minimum size of frame needed, which is the transmission delay has to be greater than 2 times the propagation delay. And if you remember back to one of the review sessions, I think the second one, we talked about the transmission delay is the minimum size, is the packet size of the data rate. So the minimum size has to be the transfer rate times 2 times the propagation. So if you don't adhere to this principle, if there's no minimum size frame, then you wouldn't be able to detect collisions, and the whole collision detection part of the algorithm wouldn't work anymore. And that's why this is important. So I just shamelessly ripped this off in the 244A lecture handout. So suppose you have just two nodes, A and B, and they're connected to each other on this shared plane, plus with some other nodes attached to it in between. So we assume that it takes a prop to get from A to B and a prop to get from B to A. And these are the two most separated nodes along this wire. So if A just starts transmitting a frame, and then and just before A finishes getting the frame over here, so it takes just before the frame gets to B, so like after a prop minus, B starts sending a frame to A, that frame will take another prop to get back. So if you don't wait at least two prop, you won't ever know if the packet you sent to B made it there without colliding. Because B could have just sent a packet at a prop minus and it gets back to you at two prop. If you don't wait at least 2 times the propagation delay, you'll never know if if the frame you sent down actually collided with somebody else's frame. So that's why you have to wait at least 2 times the propagation delay. Figure out if there's a collision. And that's what constrains the minimum frame size in CSMA/CD.
So,
if you're on an Ethernet network that's like 280 meters or whatever the next is, what is the propagation time? I mean, is it anything that's greater than trivial?
Yeah, it's governed by the speed of light, right? So you can just do the math. Generally, you can't do the division one.
It takes 10 milliseconds to get from here to here. So it's definitely much less than 10 milliseconds.
Yeah.
So for us,
so the effect of this is basically your cable length has to be shorter because that'll reduce the other side of the inequality, the two prop inequality. So clearly, if your cable is shorter, then the prop is going to be shorter across the cable. And then you don't have to have as big a minimum size. Right?
So if, as we were just talking about, this isn't really used that much anymore, then can you have like cross-country links that just don't rely on collision detection?
Yeah, but the thing is, right? I mean, these links only like go so far without attenuation, right? So, and at some point you need a repeater anyway, so you couldn't have created like one for one. And most of the cross-country links now are optical, and that's like a different idea, right? So. Yeah. But anyway, this is just rehash. There was a section, there was a slide in the lecture on this, but I don't know if everyone totally got that. So that's the reason for the minimum size frame. See, that's what happens when you have a collision. So you don't wait that long, you won't detect the collision, and then that is happening. That's your algorithm depends on detecting the collision. Okay, and then finally, like I said, I mean, everything now is going point to point. It's not just a network, it's everywhere in the computer, right? And the basic thing is buses are nice, like things where you have one wire and multiple guys share access to that one wire, one medium, where you share, you know, share that medium. They're nice because obviously you only need one lane for one air. One anything, but it's also slow because only you have to keep arbitrating access to it, right? So you see everywhere in computing, this is everywhere in computing, all these buses that you used to see in your system are turning into point-to-point links, just links from one node directly to another, which obviously requires ordinates for links and nodes. But so it requires more links, but it's clearly faster because you don't have to do this arbitration. Right, so in multi-core CPUs, you have this thing called the frontside bus that's connected on the CPUs. Most of this is like moving to a point-to-point link, so like hypertransport, and all the CPUs are connected to each other. I mean, it's a little more complex, but yeah, it's moving from a bus to point-to-point links. Hard drive, you have this parallel idea thing that was a bus, now you go to serial idea that's point-to-point. Peripheral cards, you have PCI that was a bus, now we've got the PCI Express, that's point-to-point. Networking, you have this shared Ethernet, so you have like this shared one coaxial cable, or you have this cable that's connected to a hub that's basically the same as a shared cable. Well, that's gone away. It's got the switch Ethernet. So the switch is going to terminate the nodes, the links. So the switch is connected to, suppose that this X is a switch. Each of these wires is a terminate. Is terminated basically. So the collision detection only has to happen across these two links. They will never collide, so you'll never run that collision detect algorithm. So if you use switching, you will never get any of this collision stuff, and it doesn't actually matter anymore. But in wireless, it still matters, so that's why we're still talking about it. Give you an idea of what's going on with this arbitration. Something on Manchester. Yeah, why not? We're only 1 minute over, so let's start. So remember, we talked about Manchester coding quickly on Thursday, and this is just a way to encode the clock signal into your data. So in a traditional digital system, you have some clock speed, right? Like your processor running at 100 megahertz or 1 gigahertz or something. So it's running at 100 megahertz. Every 10 nanoseconds, there's a beep in the system that tells all the samplers in your chip to sample the signal, right? So you have to have something that tells the digital system, okay, here's the beep in the system, here's a clock. And usually that's paired along a separate clock wire, but in networking, we don't actually have a separate clock wire on the Ethernet cable, right? So the question is, how do you carry that clock signal across the wire? And one way to do this is using Manchester code. So basically, if you sample one, you transmit a rising edge. And if you sample zero, you encode a falling edge. So it might be easier to see here. So suppose the data is just all zeros all the time, and the clock is there. So basically, on those red lines, we're sampling the data. So we're going to sample zero every time the clock rises. So remember we said that the encoding for a zero is a falling edge here. Right? So we just draw a falling edge at every rising clock edge. and we connect the calling edges together, and that's the actual signal that we get out of the network card if we're using the edges. So logically, you see all zeros, but the way you encode it is with a series of calling edges. And here's a sample problem. Number of bit transitions and using a region table. And I'll post it on the website. So and then, so basically the idea is you could run a transform on this encoding to figure out the actual clock region. Anything else?
We're supposed to test the frame against the requirements. So
yeah.
Is there like a number that's defined?
Well, the frame should be at least the size of the Ethernet header and not bigger than 1518, right? Because that's the total size of the Ethernet, or the payload should not be greater than 1518. Is that right? I think the total length has to be less than 1518 bytes, and it has to be at least the size of the Ethernet header. If it's not at least the size of the Ethernet header, we should look at the right reference and call the second one.
Okay, so then we just throw away all the
Yeah, you should throw away packets that don't make sense, right? If you get a packet and checksum's wrong, you can't trust anything in it, so just throw it away. If you get a packet that's smaller than yours, like the Ethernet header size, you can't trust anything in it, so throw it away. Right, so we'll post the test scores in like an hour or two.
So we can curve them.
Oh, okay. Okay, maybe not tomorrow.